From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker is testifying before the House Judiciary Committee today. Democrats had threatened to subpoena him if he wouldn't come voluntarily. Whitaker, in turn, said he wouldn't show up if they did. In the end, they worked out a deal, and Whitaker appeared without a subpoena. But he didn't have many answers for Democrats who pressed him about his oversight of the special counsel investigation. We're joined now by NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas in Washington. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
So let's start with a lengthy exchange here between Whitaker and the Democratic committee chair, Gerald Nadler. Nadler's questioning Whitaker about briefings on the Mueller investigation and Whitaker's decision not to recuse himself from overseeing that investigation since he had criticized it before he became acting attorney general. Here he is.
It is our understanding that at least one briefing occurred between your decision not to recuse yourself on December 19th and 6 days later, Christmas Day. Is that correct? Simple enough question. Yes or no?
Mr. Chairman, I again, what is the basis for your question? You're saying that it is your...
Sir, I'm asking the questions. I only have 5 minutes. So please answer yes or no.
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to... You were asking me a question. It is your understanding. Can you tell me where you get the basis?
No, I'm not going to tell you that. I don't have time to get into that. I'm just asking you if that's correct or not. Is it correct? Were you briefed... in that time period between December 19th and Christmas Day, simple question, yes or no?
Congressman, if every member here today asked questions based on their mere speculation...
All right, never mind.
At
any point...
Actual basis
yes or no,
at
any, yes or no, at any point since that briefing, have you communicated any information you learned in that briefing to President Trump?
Okay, so Whitaker took 9 seconds to respond to that last question and reiterated that he wouldn't talk about any conversations he may have had with the president. Now, the reason we played that is because after that happened, Whitaker told Nadler that his five-minute clock had run out. Did Democrats get anything that they wanted out of this hearing, or what do you make of what we heard there?
Well, they didn't get a lot of answers to questions that they had regarding Whitaker's communications with the president. But exchanges like that between the chairman and the acting attorney general, those are not bad things for Democrats. That is actually a positive. Whitaker, for many people, is not going to come off well. It is almost unheard of for a witness in a congressional congressional hearing to challenge the chairman like that and say, well, I think your 5 minutes are up. So the fact that he didn't have answers plays to the Democrats' advantage, I think. And certainly it allowed Democrats to continue to keep the issues that they want to in headlines going forward. And those are issues of, were there communications between Whitaker and the president? Why did Whitaker get this job? And also what he has done in terms of oversight of the special counsel's
investigation. Did Democrats get any assurances about the integrity of the Mueller investigation being maintained under Whitaker?
They did. Whitaker testified under oath that he has not interfered in any way, shape, or form with the investigation. He said that the special counsel's regulations have been followed to a T during his time as acting attorney general. Remember, he took over on an acting basis after Attorney General Jeff Sessions resigned under pressure from the White House in November. So November, December, January, we're in February. Now, that's the time that Whitaker has been in charge. They got that sort of assurance from him. But remember, Whitaker is only going to be around for probably no more than another week. The president's pick to be the next attorney general, William Barr, is expected to be confirmed by the Senate next week.
Now, the proceedings began with a partisan conflict. The ranking member, Republican Doug Collins, called the hearing pointless and motioned to adjourn. He was denied that after a vote, but here's how he set the tone.
We now have the reason for this hearing. It has nothing to do with the oversight of DOJ. It has everything to do, as we found out this morning in a document dump from the Democratic side of this committee and also another committee, that this is nothing more than a character assassination. And we're going to also decide to see if we can just do something and get at the president while we had the chance.
What kind of questions did Republicans ask of Whitaker?
Well, a number of the questions from Republicans tied back into investigations that they conducted when they were in charge of this committee under the last Congress. So questions that they have about the Justice Department, about the FBI, and how they handled the high-profile investigations, particularly ones relating to the president, decisions that were made. And they also spent a lot of time really dinging Democrats over this exact hearing, saying – kind of as Collins did, that this has nothing to do with oversight. You guys don't want to ask about the Department of Justice and what it's doing. You guys just want to go after the president and the DOJ.
The tables have turned in the House of Representatives, it appears. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas watching the hearing on Capitol Hill today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, another story we're watching today involves the richest man in the world, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos. Social media has been on fire ever since Bezos said yesterday that the company that owns the National Enquirer tried to extort him. And we're going to start our Friday social media roundup with that story. Femi Okay is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Peter.
So let's lay this out for people. Jeff Bezos says that American Media Inc., or AMI, it's the owner of the National Enquirer, threatened to blackmail him by publishing intimate photos he'd sent to a woman who was not his wife. Bezos did not back down. He wrote about it in a blog post on Medium, and social media has weighed in ever since.
Absolutely. That Medium post where people can post longer form blogs, writings did really, really well. Over 150,000 people have seen that. More people have seen the tweet leading them to that posting, and people are weighing in. There's some baggage that comes with Jeff Bezos. So people are weighing in terms of what he does at the Washington Post, what he's been doing with Amazon. For instance, we have here from Hubert Elsky. If only you cared as much about Amazon employees' working conditions as you do about your reputation. Hint, greatly improving the first will hugely improve the latter. Lots of empathy, though, for Bezos. For every Windy City posting on Twitter, I like Bezos even more now, who actually reads the National Enquirer. Every time I walk by the magazine, I cringe at the covers.
It's interesting that he didn't publish this story in the Washington Post, which he owns, that he actually drew attention to the blog post on Medium by tweeting about it, and that's when it caught on. And so in that way, it is very almost purely a social media story.
Exactly. And people on social are saying that the reason he did this was because he owns the Washington Post. So that may not be a good use of the fact that he's the owner publishing his own story. Then the Washington Post has to fact check the story, becomes all kind of a complex conversation. And so he did it on himself by himself with his own blog post.
And I just want to point out that Amazon is a financial supporter of NPR. There is another story all over social media this week. Conversations about blackface again. Two top Democrats in Virginia.
We just talked about this.
We just did. You were talking, I believe, last week about Florida's new Republican Secretary of State that stepped down because of the fact that he was in blackface. Now we have this crisis in Virginia. What have you seen on that?
Well, the conversations are evolving, so it's not just SMH or shaking my head, as you would say, online. It's not just that. And not just facepalming. There's a lot of facepalming going on, particularly as it's Black History Month. I think this is the kind of Black history that we probably don't want to be revisiting every February. But people are just breaking down the stories that they know, that they've experienced, and trying to work out, well, how do you get a sense of forgiveness if these deeds have been so incredibly racist. Justin Zimmerman remembers being at the University of Alabama, and they had an event called the Old South Day while he was an undergrad, and the white fraternities and sororities would dress up in antebellum attire, and that finally stopped in 2008.
Wow. Twitter's kind of a tough place to have a productive conversation about this. Are you seeing, you know, meaningful dialogue between people?
Conversations about, well, how do you go past this and forgive this? And people are actually being very willing to share what happened to them in the 80s and the 90s and the fact that they dressed up or their parents dressed them up and put brown face or black face makeup on them. But then if everybody who has a black face photograph or image in their social media platforms, if they all had to resign, who would be left? How many people would be left? So how do you get by this? What is a genuine apology? Those are the conversations that are going on now. And people are beginning to out themselves as well.
Interesting.
I did blackface.
Right.
I was 19. Yeah. It wasn't really my fault.
Which is a tough thing to admit publicly, especially for all the world to see on social media.
Absolutely.
Okay. So the internet was not a complete disaster this week. In fact, there was an effort underway to reclaim social media as a place for good, Femi. How has that played out?
Sounds like an onion joke,
doesn't
it?
Hold on. Is that possible?
Is that possible? Ah, we're so cynical. So Reclaim Social is an idea that's really set up by NGOs and charities and companies that have sort of a social consciousness about them and want to do good in the world. And they're looking at social the same way that we do, and seeing that sometimes it can be a cesspool of hate and very salacious and not very productive. And if you look at this hashtag, Reclaim Social, you will see what some of the big and some of the tiny charities and volunteers around the world are doing to actually tell good stories. Vinay Nair says on social, it's so inspiring to scroll through this hashtag Reclaim Social feed and just find my feed in general is much better. Amazing people doing amazing work. This is what we need to spread. Love it. So this is your assignment, everybody. Go onto social, look for Reclaim Social, and you will walk away smiling.
That's homework I can get behind, Femi. Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you very much, as always.
You're welcome.
Senator Elizabeth Warren is expected to officially enter the presidential campaign for 2020 tomorrow. She'll be the eighth Democrat to officially announce a campaign. We're going to be talking with all of them if they'll accept our invitation. And today we're joined by John Delaney. He's former Maryland congressman, has been in this race since July of 2017. Welcome to Here and Now.
It's great to be here.
So you were in this race before it was a race. What was the first moment that you remember wanting to run for president?
Well, the first time I thought about it was after Secretary Clinton lost, because, you know, as a Democrat, I wasn't planning on running against her, and I actually thought she was going to win, like I think a lot of the country. And that moment made me say we have to think differently about everything.
What is it that you think that you're going to do differently? Why do you think that we needed to think differently about things after Clinton's loss?
Well, I think we really need to move to a bit of a postpartisan world where we actually start solving problems and stop kind of living in a country where, you know, the political leaders act like half the country's entirely wrong about everything they believe and increasingly try to pit American against American.
Do you think it's possible to do that, though, especially if the other side, let's say that you came in and you became president and you said, we're going to live in a postpartisan world and we're all going to be friends with each other, but the other side doesn't want to do that as well. Doesn't it make it impossible to be done?
Well, I'm not saying it's easy, right? And I'm not saying we should want to live in a world where we agree with each other on everything. We absolutely shouldn't want to live in that world. We'd want to have a debate of ideas. And that's the whole point of the political process. But we also have to start spending some of our time focused on the things we agree with each other on, because there's a long list of things where I actually think there's broad agreement in this country that we need to act and do something, but it never gets done because it's not of interest to the extremes on each side, who, in my opinion, have largely held this country hostage for decades.
Let's go through some issues. First of all, health care. You are not in favor of Medicare for All, correct?
That's right. I'm not in favor of the Medicare for All bill that is proposed in the U.S. Senate specifically, right? Because the term Medicare for All sometimes doesn't mean anything, mm-hmm. but there is actually a bill that Senator Sanders and a lot of the other people who are running for president have crafted in the Senate. I am not for that bill. I am for a system of universal health care where every American has health care as a fundamental right, because I think that's where we should be as a civilized society.
Through
I think
private insurance or government?
Well, I think the way I would do it is to some extent I'd actually use Medicare as a model. What Medicare does is you get basic health care as a right if you're over 65, and then you have the ability to buy supplemental plans so that you can have choices. So I think we need a system. My proposal is a system very similar to that. I leave Medicare alone. I create a new system for everyone under 65 where they get health care as a right. It's a basic plan. We roll Medicaid into that. But then we allow people to have choices and get private insurance to supplement that basic government plan. That's where I think we should go.
What about immigration? Would you be willing, let's say on this issue of the wall, would you be willing to allow the president to build some more fencing or some wall in order to get the Dreamers a path to citizenship?
Yes. I think there's 1.8 million people who are considered Dreamers. I think they go to bed every night worried about potentially being deported and going back to a country none of them may even know. You know, they came here as kids. They did nothing wrong. And if as part of a smart border security program, we funded some money for the kind of steel barriers that exist now on the border and we could get a deal with Dreamers, how could you not do that? Right. I mean, it's, you know, you're potentially helping 1.8 million human beings. I mean, what we should do on border security to me is pretty obvious. the Congress and the president should agree on a certain amount of money, call it $5 billion. And they should agree that experts will make recommendations as to the best way to spend that money. And it's likely that those experts would say, let's invest in technology here, let's put some more personnel here, and probably in these places we need some physical barriers. And the Congress and the president should agree on what the experts recommend.
What about trade? Would you get back into, for example, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership that President Obama wanted and President Trump didn't?
Yes, I would. I was a big supporter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I worked very closely with President Obama on that. I was one of the few Democrats to support it. I thought it was in the economic interest of the country, but in particular, I thought it was in the national security interest of the United States of America. The number one threat from a foreign policy perspective by any measure for our country is China. And, you know, Asia is the fastest growing economic region in the world. And we need to be making commitments to our allies in the Asia-Pacific region that we are there as a partner for them. And it's one of the main ways of dealing with China and what I would consider their pirate-like practices over the last several decades, to be competing with them in their backyard.
You founded two finance companies, and I wonder what you think about the fact that 10 years after the financial crisis and all the new regulations that went into place, that so many of them were taken back. Do you think that Wall Street is adequately regulated right now?
I think the financial system in the United States of America right now is very well capitalized and is safe and largely in a good position to withstand an economic crisis, right, which is the most important thing. Because last time we allowed our banks to be way undercapitalized and they operated with kind of a heads they win, tails the taxpayers lose mentality, and it largely brought down a big part of the U.S. economy. So firstly, and I think most importantly, we have a very strong and well-capitalized financial system in this country. I think regulations on larger financial institutions are largely appropriate, and I fully support the Dodd-Frank regime to regulations. But I do believe we are seeing a rapid decline in the number of community banks in this country. And I think we have to say, you know, we have to decide as a country, do we want to still have these community banks? Because we can't subject them to the same level of regulations that the largest financial institutions have because they just can't afford it. And as a result, they're rapidly kind of being consolidated.
Do you think that Elizabeth Warren is too tough on the banks?
I think she perceives the banks to be a bigger problem right now than they are. In other words, the banks were a much bigger problem going into the financial crisis. I think right now, just to put it into perspective, the risk of automation and artificial intelligence, which is likely to displace 50 million jobs or fundamentally change them by 2030, for example, is a much bigger conversation for us to be having about the economy and jobs, et cetera, in this country than the banks, which are largely pretty well capitalized and have been appropriately regulated since the financial crisis. The next crisis is never the same as the last crisis. So I think walking around and acting like the banks are the big problem in this country is really not the right issue. The right issue is, how is our economy fundamentally changing? How is it disrupting jobs and work? And how is it leading to a tremendous concentration of opportunity in a relatively small number of places in this country? I mean, last year in the United States of America, 80% of the venture capital was invested in 50 counties out of 3,100 counties. So you have this tremendous concentration of opportunity that's based on all these changes, technology, globalization, et cetera. And those are much bigger things to get our head around than what's going on in the banking system.
Some of what a president does has to do with the present moment, and some of it is about the future and,
yep,
and setting, laying the groundwork for the future. We've done a lot of stories on this program about Generation Z, and one of the things that they're dealing with is very high rates of suicide, depression. Many people are looking at how much kids are using devices right now. What do you think is the biggest problem facing the youngest generation in this country?
Well, I think devices is a big issue. I mean, I think we've allowed these technology companies who have real monopoly power to effectively develop devices that are clearly addictive. And we have, you know, no regulation on them largely at all. I sponsored legislation in the Congress to have the NIH do a study on the addictive nature of devices. Mm-hmm. So I think a combination of social media addiction, I think a combination of, you know, very concentrated economic opportunity where about 70-80% of the kids in this country live in a community where the jobs that are being created are not as good as the jobs that used to exist, which has led to fractured families, a large mental health crisis, a public education system that really hasn't been updated to deal with the demands of the world we live in now. I think there's a convergence of all these factors that is creating huge despair in our country in every generation, including, you know, and listen, I have four daughters, right? So I'm, you know, ages 11 to 26. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I kind of am pretty close to these issues, and I think they're a real issue.
I'm going to ask you one more question. We're going to be asking everybody this question, which is, what scares you? Now, it could be something that scares you about the country, but it could also be, you know, spiders. Whatever it is, tell me what scares you, John Delaney.
Well, what scares me is the level of division in our country. I worry that we're going to live in a world where future political disagreements are met with violent protests because we can't have any normal conversations anymore. And people are looking for villains, and typically they're looking for people who are in a different political party. And we haven't done things to control the disinformation wars that can happen in a largely unregulated technology environment that we live in. I worry about a world where people will look at their phones, see something they like, and smile, and the phone will know that, and it'll immediately give them an image of, you know, and the image might be a complete fake scenario where they took someone's face and voice and imposed it in a scene designed to influence what they buy and what or how they vote. And that this really erodes the basic fabric of our society. So I really worry about the deep, deep divisions in our country because I think this is a magnificent country and we can solve every single problem in front of us, but we have to solve them all together. And if we're divided, we can't.
That is John Delaney, a former Maryland congressman. He is running for the Democratic nomination in 2020. John Delaney, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, we'll talk to all of the candidates for 2020 if they accept our invitations.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
It's 12:15. You're listening to Radio KFFX.
The opening lines of what's been dubbed the longest-running blues radio broadcast in American history. Sunshine Sonny Payne hosted King Biscuit Time from Helena, Arkansas from 1951 until his death last February. The show highlighted the work of some of the most famous blues musicians in America.
Pass the biscuits, cause it's King Biscuit Time on KFFA Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, Robert Jr. Lockwood and the King Biscuit Entertainers.
Journalist Aaron Scott interviewed Sonny Payne a few years before his death at the age of 92. She asked the radio host about his early days working at KFFA, where King Biscuit Time was produced. Payne started his career as a janitor in the 1940s with dreams of making it big.
I told some of my guys hanging around, I'm going on the air, man, beat your heart out. Had that broom and a mop and everything. I'm mopping the floors and running errands, and I did that for almost a year.
And then Payne caught a break. He put down his mop and picked up a microphone. Payne quickly grew King Biscuit Time's reputation as the go-to place for Delta blues. At the time, it was hard to find African-American artists on the radio. Payne explained how the show became a household name.
These ladies would go to the beauty shop. What is that they're playing? A sonny boy. They tell a lady, call up there and tell her my name, say, Jesse Jones. Don't you mention my name, my husband will kill me. Tell her to play me a blues song. Caught on like that. Like that. I'll tell you how quick it caught on.
King Biscuit Time was named after the local flower company. It helped inspire and build the careers of legends like Robert Nighthawk, Ike Turner, Levon Helm, and B.B. King.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray.
Blues and folklore expert William Ferris described the show's influence this way.
That was the beginning of popular culture, where you could all of a sudden hear a blues singer all over the region and even beyond. People began to listen to this music in ways that were never possible before.
We done played 90 countries around the world, and I tell them to hum, because a lot of them don't speak English.
The way we were taught in radio, and I said radio, I didn't say television, the less you talk, the more music you play. Leave all that alone. Just give the announcement, the name of the bands, and the name of the song, the big hit, so-and-so. That's all right. I'll go to my grave and swear by that.
Payne died a year ago this weekend. He was 92. Aaron Scott recorded the interviews in 2015. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm checking up on my baby. Find out what you put down.
Another blast of Arctic air is putting Minneapolis in a deep freeze today. Temperatures are near 30 below zero with the wind chill, which makes it a good day to check back in on the story we covered in December when the largest ever outdoor homeless camp in Minneapolis was dismantled. Up to 80% of the people who lived there were Native American, and several had died of apparent drug overdoses. Then, in mid-December, an experimental shelter opened in partnership with the Red Lake Nation. It was described to us as low-barrier housing. People who were drunk or high wouldn't be turned away. So let's see how they're doing now. Steve Horsfield is director of Simpson Housing, the nonprofit that runs the shelter. Steve, brutal cold today, and the polar vortex last week. How have you been handling it? Has anyone been left out in the cold?
Unfortunately, someone is always left out in the cold, given the limited housing resources we have as a community. That being said, the community response last week was tremendous. It was interesting. People would call and ask me about the Navigation Center in particular, and our residents there didn't have to be out braving the elements during the day. If they didn't have someplace to be, they could stay hunkered down like many of us would choose to do when it's 30 degrees below zero.
So you were at capacity?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. We first learned about what you were doing just before many of those people were moved out of the outdoor camp and into your shelter. And we were struck by your approach to the rules, that people would not be turned away, for example, if they were drunk or high. What's the philosophy behind a choice like that?
It's pretty simple and straightforward. If we solve the question of housing first and get people into stable housing and a better environment, people ultimately do make better choices for themselves. We have all sorts of studies being done that show clinical results of people's harmful behaviors reducing in terms of alcohol and drugs and other things.
But many people were struggling with drug addiction who were living in the outdoor camp. And as they moved into your facility, it's not like that problem went away. We see that one person died in January of an apparent overdose inside your shelter. What can you tell us about that?
I should note that the medical examiner's report on that tragic death was not conclusive around the overdose.
Sure.
So the whole premise of the Navigation Center is safety. So we've got folks who are going off into treatment beds. We've got folks who are finding safer alternatives to use that are part of the community that we moved in because we wanted to make sure that we brought everyone in to a safer environment with as few barriers as possible.
I take your point that it's not conclusive yet what happened with the apparent overdose. Minnesota Public Radio is reporting that people who are living there do say that drug use still does happen on site and that overdoses are common. I mean, do you see that as a problem where you are?
Well, I mean, the opioid epidemic is a problem, period. I think we would all agree that 400 people dying on the streets of Minneapolis of overdose death in 2018 is awful. And it's something that we as a community need to respond to. And yes, some of the people who came to us from the encampment are drug users, and we're interested in working with them, building relationships with those folks to help them be safer.
How's your staff trained to deal with that?
Our staff are trained to administer Narcan in the event of an overdose. The real premise of how Simpson Housing Services does shelter is being in relationship with people, and we believe that that is where the best work can happen. So being in a relationship with our guests allows us to have open dialogue about what choices they're making and how can we help them be safer.
Well, the other key to this story is that the majority of your residents are Native American. How does that affect your approach to what you're doing?
Oh, we've got Native elders who come in and do prayer and smudging, and we have drum circles at different times.
And what is smudging?
Smudging is the burning traditionally of sage, also of cedar. So it is a method by using this smoldering organic material and the smoke that comes from it to bless people and spaces. It's quite fragrant. And I tell you, it just the way that it affects spaces and the way people interact and even my own stress level when I get to participate in those practices is you can really feel it.
You're working at the intersection of a lot of big issues that the country is dealing with right now. I just wonder what you've learned in the last month and a half about this model that you're using that could help other communities that are dealing with homelessness.
Yeah, I would say that, I mean, this is still very early. We ramped this thing up, built it for with an intended population of 120 folks. When we finally got everybody moved in and cleared out from a couple of other temporary stops that we had for some of our from some of the residents of the encampment, we wound up with 162 people. So in our culture, for better or for worse, for a long time, we've been doing all of our work around a traditional sort of charity model, which is based in, generally speaking, white churches. And so I'm really looking forward to what Native practices can do for a broader population, not just the Native population, but for all of us, getting back to some things that are much older than how we label things in this community.
That's Steve Horsfield, Executive Director of Simpson Housing in Minneapolis. Steve, appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
Thank you so much.
The Lunar New Year began on Tuesday, and across the world, people have been celebrating with family and honoring new beginnings. In China, millions of people watched this on state-run TV. A pretty stunning spectacle of music and synchronized dancing. And there's another view on the Lunar New Year from Mongolia, where the holiday has a more rural flair. NPR's Emily Kwong has been celebrating with some herding families.
It's minus 18 degrees outside. But inside this traditional home, called a ger, it's a toasty oasis. I'm with a family of nomadic herders in the grasslands of central Mongolia. It's the big night before Lunar New Year. In Mongolia, the holiday is called Sagansar, which means white moon. Traditional holiday food is supposed to be white, too, prepared from the herder's animals. All meals start with milk tea, served to guests the moment they arrive. Slurping the milk, lightly salted, I can feel warmth returning to my hands. 65-year-old Mongolian herder Chajinku Basinku is telling me to eat, eat, eat. There's fermented mare's milk, dried cheese curds, even a homemade vodka distilled from yogurt. I want to see where all this food comes from, so Basinku leads me outside. Several of the family's goats are fenced in nearby. Most of them bolt as we step closer, but one baby goat moves towards my feet. This goat is trying to eat my shoelaces. And he has the right idea. A full stomach does bring luck in the new year. Sagansar has its origins in the era of Chinggis Khan and marks the symbolic end of winter. This winter for Mongolian herders has been a pretty good one. Basinku says she hopes the spring will bring even less storms and less wind. That way, herders have a better chance of making it through the year with their livestock intact. It's the morning of Sagansar, time for the big celebration. Another family, the Purevsurens, have invited me to join theirs. It feels like a family reunion. I count about 60 people in the banquet hall. They greet each other with a polite kiss or a sniff near both cheeks. The family table is laden with the back of a boiled sheep and mutton dumplings. Vodka is flowing. A kid zips across the marble floor on a scooter.
It's like playtime for the kids, mayhem for the adults, but they're mostly focused on greeting each other anyway.
How this day is spent dictates the rest of the year. They wear their best clothes, reconcile old debts, and after all the feasting, all that asking after health and well-being, members of this family stand up and sing a song in tribute to mothers.
There's a few people in the family tearing up. Yeah, getting pretty emotional. I think it's a family that's very happy to be together after another year.
The tradition of Sagansar was banned under Soviet rule. Now, it's celebrated in full force by the whole nation. Many Mongolian shops are closed to give families ample time to celebrate. Emily Kwong, NPR News, Tsetserlig, Mongolia.
The death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi is back in the news in a number of ways this week. Turkey's foreign minister today called for a United Nations investigation into the killing, which happened in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul last October. Khashoggi was a Washington Post columnist who was a critic of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. And the New York Times reported yesterday that the Crown Prince told an aide in 2017 he would use a bullet on Khashoggi unless he returned to Saudi Arabia and stopped criticizing the Saudi government. And Khashoggi was mentioned in that Medium post by Amazon owner Jeff Bezos yesterday. Joining us now is Jim Walsh, here now security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. And let's start with this New York Times report, which makes it clear that Prince Mohammed wanted Khashoggi dead. What do you make of it?
Well, at one level, I'm not surprised. I mean, it's the CIA issued a report where they concluded with medium to high confidence that he was responsible for the murder. Certainly, the circumstantial evidence is overwhelming. Now, whether we have a message where he says, I did it or not, the preponderance of evidence points in that direction, contrary to what the president said back in November. He said, well, the intelligence community has feelings about this. The CIA does not do feelings. The analysts don't do feelings. They do rigorous analysis. They vacuum up all the signals intelligence, and they render conclusions. And that conclusion seems to be sustained again and again.
But Saudi Arabia has continued to deny any involvement by the crown prince. The kingdom has indicted 11 people in connection with Khashoggi's death. There have been some court proceedings. We don't know a lot about them. Has the Trump administration done anything so far, taken any action to rebuke Saudi Arabia over this?
No. And Congress passed a bill back in the fall requiring that he report to Congress today. Today is the deadline. No one expects that to happen. I would say in other news, and we can't confirm this, but President Erdogan of Turkey has alleged that the Saudi government has killed off some of the 22 people who were involved in the operation. And certainly the head of the operation, the close advisor to the Crown Prince, is not one of those 11 people indicted.
And then there is this incredible connection to the Jeff Bezos story. So Khashoggi wrote for The Washington Post. Jeff Bezos says in this Medium post yesterday that AMI, the company that owns the National Enquirer, tried to blackmail him over an affair. And he said that AMI told him it would publish more texts and photos of Jeff Bezos if the Post didn't drop its investigation into Khashoggi's death.
Yeah, well, that certainly got the attention of federal prosecutors who are now opening up an investigation into the media company to see if they violated their cooperation deal. But you have to ask yourself, why would they do that? Why would the National Enquirer, you know, rather than enriching themselves or seeking some other purpose, why would they seek to tamp down coverage of this event? And, you know, without knowing, it would the hypotheses that leap to mind are either they have a Saudi connection or they're attempting to cover for the president.
Well, and it also, if you think about it in another way, we've talked about the fact that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, are very close, both young guys, you know, very accomplished people, but very close people, that potentially that person who's very close to the president actually killed or, you know, ordered the killing of an employee of Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, I get sort of personal at that point. But let me say, this is horrific. And, you know, the more details, the more gruesome it becomes. But I think it's also important to keep in mind the big picture. There are a couple of larger things going on here. As horrific and condemnable the murder was, Saudi Arabia has been engaged in a whole bunch of other stuff that's worse that no one paid attention to until the murder. The war in Yemen, right. The biggest humanitarian crisis on the planet, where Saudi Air Force is using American munitions to indiscriminately kill civilians, where they blockaded and prevented the UN from providing humanitarian relief at the time of a cholera outbreak when millions of people are on the brink of starvation. So that's bad. I mean, the murder is bad, and we should all be outraged by it. But there are larger things afoot that should raise concern, deep red flags about the direction of Saudi Arabia and raise questions. And I hate to say this, but raise questions about the relationship between the president and his intelligence community. I mean, if the president comes out and essentially lies about what the CIA is doing, that is not going to instill a lot of confidence in the agency.
The other thing that's interesting here is Saudi Arabia's big rival in the region is Iran. The president just the other day in the interview before the Super Bowl told CBS that he wanted to keep some troops in Iraq to keep an eye on Iran, something that the Saudis would love to have him do.
Yeah, he did that without contacting the Iraqis first. I would say normally in foreign policy is a good protocol. Before you announce you're going to keep a bunch of troops in a foreign country, you should probably talk to the foreign country first. But yes, that sounds like mission creep. That sounds to the Iranians like perhaps we're setting up for, you know, a military attack. So how is Iran going to respond to that as a threat? They're going to prepare for war.
Jim, one question real quick. Do you think that Mohammed bin Salman's job as crown prince is still in danger now?
I've always said all along that it's still more likely he'll survive this than not politically. Again, he's an autocrat. He's an absolute monarch, and he's got a ton of cash, and those two things are very powerful. But there will be an interim step after the king dies where the family gets together and has to decide, do we want to go in this direction? And that remains unclear.
Jim Walsh, Here Now security analyst. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.